Well, turn back, if you would, to 1 Samuel 27. And we're going to be looking through that chapter. We might read a little bit more later on as well. We were getting back into this book of the Bible after a little break. And so just to give you another little recap, just to refresh a little bit of the story so far. Saul is the king of Israel, but he didn't last very long before he disobeyed God and went his own way. And God said he would raise up a new king, a king after his own heart. And in chapter 16 of the book of 1 Samuel, David, this shepherd boy, is anointed to be the next king of Israel. In chapter 17, quite famously, he defeats Goliath and he rises to be a commander in Israel's army. And in the chapters that follow, 9 chapters, David really goes through the mill. Saul is jealous. Perhaps he sees the potential. Perhaps he begins to understand that David is going to be his replacement. And at least twice he tries to spear him. And David has to flee. And David is hunted. And he's betrayed by different people. And he's constantly on the run through 9 whole chapters. And those 9 chapters make a great action story. And they're exciting to read. But it might be the kind of thing you ask at a couple of points, I wonder what David's blood pressure was like. I wonder what it felt like to live through those things. And I think these 9 chapters, a little bit always difficult to work out the time scale of that exactly, especially in the life of Saul. He's one of the characters in the Bible that his timing's a little difficult to get your head around, how long it lasts. But, you know, it's taken its toll on David. So the first thing we notice here in this chapter this evening, chapter 27, is David's despair. You notice it there at the beginning, that first verse. David said in his heart, "Now I shall perish someday by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me than that I should speedily escape to the land of the Philistines, and Saul despair of me to seek me any more in any part of Israel, so I shall escape out of his hand." David reaches this low point and concludes there in that first verse, "I will perish at the hand of Saul. If I stay here in the land of Israel," he has this phrase, "I'll be swept away." That's what this word perish, "I'll be swept away." He thought of Saul like this raging river. And he said, sooner or later, he's going to catch up with me and I'm going to be swept away. There's nothing better for me. That's this idea. There's nothing for me here. There is no point staying here in the land of Israel. There's nothing good for me here. Verse 1, he says, "So I shall speedily escape to the land of the Philistines." And then we're told in verse 2, "Then David arose and went over." Went over. Over the border into the land of the Philistines. And it's sad to read of it, isn't it? And perhaps we know something of the significance of that. The land of Israel wasn't just a little geographical relocation. The land of Israel was God's promised land for his people. The Philistines had been their enemy from the very start. To abandon the promised land and go and live with God's enemies is a very big step to take. And David actually spoke a little bit about it in the previous chapter. You might remember last time. David sort of talks about whether there's people who've stirred Saul up against him. And he says this in chapter 26 and verse 19. "If the Lord has stirred you up against me, let him accept an offering. But if it's the children of men, may they be cursed before the Lord. For they have driven me out this day from sharing in the inheritance of the Lord, saying, go serve other gods." David's sort of posing these hypothetical enemies who've been bad-mouthing him to Saul, so that Saul's hunting him. And they might as well be saying, and driving him out of the promised land, and driving him away from the place where God was worshipped. And so, they might as well be saying, go worship other gods. And that's the way David talks about it in only just the chapter before. And now he does it. Oh, he feels himself driven out of the promised land. And he's now away from the place where God was worshipped amongst his people. And there he was. And it's sad to read of this despair that David experiences, isn't it? After all these hardships, perhaps we could say about him, he's reached his breaking point. And he's now anxious that maybe he won't even live to tell the tale. He's overwhelmed by the situation that's around him, his experiences with Saul that have gone on for some time. He concludes in the end, there's no hope here. He's going to be swept away by Saul. And it's a sad place to be in, isn't it? Maybe as well there's the pressure of leadership in verse 2. It refers to David arose and went over with the 600 men who were with him to Achish, the son of Maach, the king of Gath. And so David went to Achish at Gath, he and his men, each man with his household, and David with his two wives. So it's not just David's band of 600 men, but each of them have their households to worry about. And so it's not just David concerned for saving his own skin, but he's concerned for his 600 loyal men, and each of them have a household. Maybe each of them, David's got two wives, that's not great, but anyway. But the others at least might have had one wife. Maybe they had children as well. This could have been a group that easily numbered 1,500, 2,000, depending on how many children they've all got, and whether they're talking about other relatives that are their responsibilities too. This could be a big group of people that David is trying to keep them all safe from King Saul. And so he leaves and goes to the land of the Philistines. He goes to Achish, the king of Gath. They have met before, back in chapter 21. Quite early on in his conflicts with Saul, he escaped into the land of the Philistines and went to Gath. Bit of a strange place to go to, because that, of course, was Goliath's hometown. And it went very badly. When he arrived there the first time, they all recognized who he was, and David had to pretend to be insane to escape. And now he comes back to Achish, but much more bold up front this time, perhaps telling Achish some of the trouble that he'd experienced and so on. And he comes and lives under Achish care. And we might notice it works. Verse 4, so it was told Saul that David had fled to Gath, so he sought him no more. It seemed to work, we might say. David is then given a town to call home, this place called Ziklag, and he works as a mercenary for Achish, a gun for hire. David and his 600 men, they would carry out Achish's instructions. He sort of assumed a little extra part of the army, sort of a mercenary band as part of the Philistine army. That leads then to the second thing we notice, David's deception. In the end, David's given this little town, so he's got a little bit more freedom to come and go as he pleases. And so David would go out and carry out raids. In verse 8, we're told he raided the Geshurites and the Gerizzites and the Amalekites. All of those were Israel's enemies. Even now David is in exile, he's still trying to help Israel and protect its interests and protect it from its enemies. And those three were part of that. But he tells Achish, verse 10, when Achish would ask, where have you made a raid today? David would say, against the southern area of Judah, or against the southern area of the Jeremelites, or the southern area of the Kenites. David would tell Achish that he's been raiding against Israel and its allies. So it's all a con, isn't it? Oh, we might say David, at the very least, is being a double agent. He's there living in Philistine territory, pretending to be looking after Philistine interests for Achish, but he's doing the opposite. He's seeking, of course, Israel's interests. Achish believes that David is a loyal servant of his and has severed all ties with his homeland. Verse 12. Achish believed David. He believed in him. He trusted David. That's a really strong word. He has made his people Israel utterly abhor him. Therefore, he will be my servant forever. Achish believed that David was a loyal servant and trusted these things he said. But to keep up the deception, David has to kill anyone who knows the truth. Verse 11. So David would save neither man nor woman alive to bring news to Gath, saying, lest they inform on us, saying, thus David did. Because dead men tell no tales, do they? And that's what David was concerned about. In the end, somebody would tell Achish what he was really up to. And so David, as part of this plan of deception, has to kill anyone who would tell the truth. As they went out on their raiding armies to these different places, they had to make sure they left no one alive, or no one saw them where they came and went and attacked and so on. And this goes on, we're told, for 1 year and 4 months, end of verse 7. For 16 months this happens. He's going out for these different attacks, and David would raid these places, verse 9. Many people would be killed. He would take away the sheep, the oxen, the donkeys, the camels, the apparel. It might be then he gave a proportion of that to Achish. That would kind of make sense. Then verse 10, Achish would say, well, where does it come from? Where have you been raiding and so on? There's David's deception. And again, I guess we want to be a little bit sympathetic to David. He's pragmatic, isn't he? He's trying to survive in some very desperate times. We don't want to come down too hard on him. And none of us have lived such a life of going through such difficult conditions, being hunted, having a price on your head, being betrayed, having to live with enemies and then try and walk some sort of tightrope. He was still trying to help his own people in the land of Israel. And yet he needed to keep the Philistines on side so he had some sort of protection and a safe place to live and so on. And so he just does these things. But it certainly is a tangled web of lies, isn't it, that he is spreading. Third thing we see is David's almost disaster. But the way it's told, it's David's disaster. It just is painted in that bleak way. Then as you turn into chapter 28, verse 1, now it happened in those days that the Philistines gathered their armies together for war to fight with Israel. And Achish said to David, you assuredly know that you will go out with me to battle, you and your men. So David said to Achish, surely you know what your servant can do. And Achish said to David, therefore I will make you one of my chief guardians forever. Here is David's disaster. The Philistines are preparing for a battle with Israel. And this loyal band of mercenaries are called up to fight as well. After all, as Achish has believed in chapter 27, verse 12, that David has cut all ties with the land of Israel, and he is a loyal servant now of the Philistines. And so one day Achish comes to David and says, right, you need to mobilize your men. You're marching with me, and we're going to the assembly point where we're going to meet the other armies of the Philistines. We're getting ready for a war with Israel. And you can imagine how David's head began to spin at this point. What's he going to do? How's it come to this? He is the future king of Israel, and he's about to go into battle against Israel. How is this going to pan out well? What is he meant to do? This tangled web of lies has now, it seemed, completely stuck him on the wrong side of the battle line, isn't it? the one that the Israelites looked to in the early chapters, 16, 17, and so on in the book, to fight their battles. Again, it's referred to several times, most recently in chapter 25. Abigail refers to him as the man who fights the Lord's battles. And now David is on the wrong side of the battle line. He's allied himself with the Philistines. Or at least it looks like it, doesn't it? What's he going to do? Is he going to tell the truth? Is he going to say to Achish, "No, I'm sorry, I can't go with you into battle. In fact, Achish, I've been deceiving you the whole time. All those raids you thought I was going on to look after your interests, I've actually been defending Israel's interests the whole time." At the very least, he loses a head. I mean, that's quite a big thing. He's a traitor, isn't he? He's promised to be a faithful servant of Achish. What's he going to do? Tell the truth? Or does he go along? Does he go along with the Philistine armies? Does he hope at some point he might be able to turn the tides? We'll come on to that a bit more in a moment. But at the very least, once he is seen to be marching with the Philistines, does he lose his claim to the throne? How can the people of Israel ever accept him as king if he's fought against Israel? How can he ever be their king? How would they ever accept him in that way? It's David's disaster. And that's where the writer of the book just sort of cuts off this bit of the story. And then in verse 3, he takes us back to the story of Saul. We'll come back and look at a little bit more in a moment. But it's good, isn't it, just to sort of leave it on that cliffhanger, as the writer does, to think, well, how did it come to this? In Proverbs chapter 12, no, Proverbs chapter 14, verse 12, it says this: "There is a way that seems right to a man, but its end is the way of death." That's one of those Proverbs of Solomon. Whether it was something David talked to him about, we could only guess. There's a way that seems good, seems right to a man. And that kind of summed up this chapter, doesn't it? This seemed the best course of action to David. One of the strange things about some of these chapters in the Old Testament is when you get a chapter like this and God's never mentioned. God's not mentioned once in the whole chapter. It's all very human, this story. And on the one hand, we understand that and we sympathize with that. David's despair, and that wasn't of his making. He'd been put through such horrible situations by others, by the jealousy and hatred of Saul. That's what sort of had driven David up to this point. And we can sympathize with the way David feels. But what's he forgotten? He's forgotten God, hasn't he? And he does what seems right in his eyes. And if it was up to David, it would lead to that, to death. It would lead to a disaster. These things that David has done. David's despair leads him to join with God's enemies, to lie and deceive, to make some sort of pledge to be a servant of Achish. It's all a sham. It's all a con. It leads to him having to have this unnecessary bloodshed to make sure no one tells the truth. And it leads to him having to march with the Philistine army towards the border of Israel. Where did it go wrong? For David. So he's not responsible for the way Saul behaved and that anger and hatred and the rest. But it went wrong, didn't it, in the first verse of our chapter 27, David said in his heart, "Now I shall perish someday by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me then I should speedily escape to the land of the Philistines, and Saul will despair of me to seek me any more in any part of Israel, so I shall escape up to his hand." That's where David went wrong. David spoke to his heart. Whether he did that out loud, whether he was literally talking to himself, or whether it's just more a phrase of sort of mulling things over, David's mulling things over in his mind, and it's all swamped with this dark despair and gloom, anxiety and fear. "I shall perish someday by the hand of Saul. I'll be swept away. There is nothing for me here. So I shall escape to the land of the Philistines." That's where David went wrong. He allowed his feelings to rule, didn't he? And that's an interesting thing to think about, perhaps a bit, especially in our sort of culture. We live in a culture where feelings often rule. "Because I feel a certain way, I've got to do this," people say. And if you talk to somebody and say, "But hang on a minute, but what about that way you're feeling?" You can actually get in a lot of trouble these days. Some people call it gaslighting and things like that. When you deny someone, or when you seem to be denying the way someone feels and things like that, and saying, no, okay, even if you try to do it quite sympathetically, as we might try and do with David here, if we were David's friend, I say, "Okay, David, yeah, I understand how you're feeling, but I don't know whether this is the right course of action," and so on. And I'm not sure you've taken everything into account here. David allows his feelings to rule, and so in verse 1 he says some things that he feels, but they're not true, are they? He says, "I shall perish someday by the hand of Saul." He felt like that. We understand that. But it wasn't true. God had promised him he would not perish. God had promised he would be king. Several times in the last couple of chapters, other people have confirmed that promise too. Jonathan comes to David earlier on and says, "My father will never find you, for everyone knows that you are the next king." Abigail says the same thing. "God has surely bound you in the bundle of the living and will hurl all of your enemies out from a sling." Even Saul, in the last chapter, has said, "You are the one who will do great things and will prevail." David feels a certain way, but some of the statements he makes were not true. He was not going to perish by the hand of Saul. The next statement, "There's nothing for me here." Again, we can understand why David felt like that. In the land of Israel, he was constantly being hunted. He was constantly being on the run. He would go and help a city of Israel, and they would then turn their backs and tell Saul where he was. It was horrible. We can understand how he feels. But when David says, "There's nothing for me here in the land of Israel," that wasn't true. This was God's promised land. This was the land where he had said he would dwell. This was the land where God could be worshipped among his people and so on. And so David says, "I shall go to the land of the Philistines, and so I shall escape out of his hands." David follows his feelings, and that leads him to put his trust in the Philistines. That's what it is, isn't it? In this first verse, "I'm going to go to the land of the Philistines, and there I'll be safe." We can understand how he felt it. We can understand the mess that he'd lived through for so long. But his feelings drive him to put his trust in the Philistines. What a dark place to end up. Is there anything else we can do in those kind of situations? Perhaps we can sympathize with David. Perhaps sometimes we can see ourselves in the same mess. When we've gone through times of trouble And when everything just clouds in on us, despair and gloom and anxiety and fear, and maybe it is a bit of a fog of feelings that we go through, and perhaps sometimes we can let our feelings rule, and we can say things and we can believe things that deep down we know aren't true. Is there another way we can react? In one of the Psalms, Psalm 42, there's another example of talking to yourself. Psalm 42, verse 5, "Why are you downcast, O my soul? Why are you disquieted within me? Hope in God, for I will yet praise him for the help of his countenance. O my God, my soul is cast down within me. Therefore, I will remember you. The Lord will command his loving kindness in the daytime, and in the night his soul shall be with me, a prayer to the God of my life. I will say to God, my rock, why have you forgotten me? The enemy reproach me all day long, saying, where is your God? Why are you downcast, O my soul? Why are you disquieted within me? Hope in God, for I shall yet praise him, the help of my countenance and my God." There's another example in one of the Psalms, isn't it, of someone talking to themselves. And they manage much better than David. David talked to himself in this chapter we're looking at, and he talked to himself of despair. And he talked to himself about all of these things which weren't really true in the factual sense, were they? Even though he felt that. Here in this psalm, we have another example of someone in despair and someone facing so many difficulties, enemies, and just feeling that God was far away. "But I will say to my soul," in this psalm, someone's talking sense to themselves in amongst all of these gloomy feelings and this fog that's descending on them. "I will hope in God. I will yet praise him. He is my rock. He is the God of my life." And so as we look at this example of David and the difficulties that he goes through, perhaps we can think too and learn as well from that situation, which we can all find ourselves, aren't we? To talk to ourselves, to look in God's word, to come back to the truth that doesn't change, even amongst the difficulties and the way that we might be despairing and struggling with life. Well, I decided I wouldn't leave David on too much of a cliffhanger, and so we're going to just look at a little bit in chapter 29. Otherwise, we just have to leave David here in this predicament for a couple of weeks before we get back to it. Because as well, in the end of this book of 1 Samuel, the writer alternates pretty much. He gives us one chapter about David, then one chapter about Saul, then another one about David, and another one about Saul. That's how he goes for a little while. And so he deliberately sort of postpones a little bit. But we're just going to read from chapter 29. We were considering, weren't we, in chapter 27, we had three things that began with D. David's despair, David's deception, and David's disaster. Or at least an almost disaster. And the writer carries on then chapter 29 with David's deliverance. David marches with the Philistines to a place called Aphek. And there David is lined up with God's enemies, preparing to fight God's people. What a nightmare. You can hardly imagine how David is. He's got entwined in a web of lies and deceit. And now he's on the wrong side of the battle line, isn't he? And then the lords of the Philistines, curiously, come to his help. And the lords of the Philistines order a review of the army before battle. And so there's a grand parade as all of the units pass by in front of the lords of the Philistines. Whether there's some saluting and things like that going on, who knows? And there at the back of the Philistine army is a band of Israelite mercenaries. David and his 600 men. And when the princes of the Philistines see them, they go ballistic. And they might as well turn to Achish as they do in verse 3. What are these Hebrews doing here? And Achish says, this is David, the servant of King Saul. He's been with me days and years. A little bit of exaggeration. I've found no fault with him ever since he defected to me. But the princes of the Philistines were angry with Achish. And they turn around to Achish and say, how stupid can you be? You can't invite David and his band of mercenaries to be there at our rear as we go into battle. What if we go in and he literally stabs us in the back? Verse 4. This could be David's best chance to reconcile him with the Israelites. Whether David was planning that, we don't know. And they say, you can't do that. Verse 5, they say, don't you remember the songs that they sang about David? Saul has slain his thousands, and David his tens of thousands. Those were tens of thousands of Philistines. He's a warrior who's fought against us. They sing songs about how many Philistines he's killed. He's definitely not going into battle with us. Achish defends David. David has been a trustworthy servant. He's without fault in my sight. He says, verse 3. But still the lords of the Philistines have decided to send the Israelites back home to Ziklag. Achish apologizes profusely in verse 6. David has been wonderful, a wonderful mercenary. He even takes an oath in God's name that everything about David has been upright. His going out, his coming in has been good in his sight. There is no evil in you since the day of your coming. It's a very eloquent lot of praise for David. It's all a complete bunkum, isn't it? It's all a hoax. David in verse 9 is compared to one of God's angels. And David carries on a bit of the pretense in verse 8. And David pretends how disappointed he is to not go into battle with the Philistines against the Israelites. If you like riddles, someone wrote this in this chapter. The deceived defends the deceiver, and the relieved denies his relief. That's what goes on in this chapter, isn't it? Achish, who's been deceived by David, is kind of upholding him and defending him and apologizing. And David, who must be secretly relieved to be let out of this, pretends he's not. And starts to complain about how he really wants to be there. Which, of course, he doesn't. And on you go. What a strange little chapter. Again, no mentions of God directly, only in Achish, who's kind of misusing his name a little bit, isn't he? But although we're not told, we might as well be at the end of the chapter. You could have a little verse that says, and thus God delivered David from the Philistines. Or perhaps, and thus God delivered David from his own mess. In another proverb, Proverbs 21 and verse 1, we read this, the king's heart is in the hand of the Lord, like the rivers of water, and he turns it wherever he wishes. Proverbs 21, verse 1. It's curious, isn't it? God uses the leaders of the Philistines, his enemies, to rescue his king from the mess he himself made. God turns the heart of the king, or the princes, in this case, the princes of the Philistines. God turns their hearts, so they're the ones who are afraid of David, so they send him home, or at least back to Ziklag. I'm unknown to David, but you kind of almost want to be hurrying on in the story all the time as you get to this point in 1 Samuel. There's a very important reason why he needs to get back to Ziklag very quick, that he doesn't know about yet. And you don't know about yet unless you've looked ahead in chapter 30, but we'll get to that another time. There's a reason God's working all of these things out. But it is as well to rescue David from this predicament that he's made. Well, as we draw these things to a close, some of these chapters in the in the story of David, you know, I think generally as you read through this book, you're sympathetic towards David. He's a guy who's trying to follow God, who's plunged into difficult situations. But chapters like 27 perhaps leave us a bit disappointed with David, don't they? And we think, come on, David, you should have trusted God a bit more. Come on, David, are you sure you had to kill quite so many people to keep your lies a secret and so on? David is only human. We read these chapters and we're forced to reconcile with it, won't we? And perhaps sometimes our children's Bibles and our Sunday school lessons that we might remember from long ago perhaps gave us these Bible heroes. And David fails to be one here, doesn't he? Or at least he shows us the truth that he's human. And we have such high hopes for him as he's going to be the future king. He's a man after God's own heart. And yet he makes such a pig's ear of things, doesn't he? In this chapter. And yet the amazing thing is that God's still going to use him. We sang just before of that parable, if you like, in this Isaiah of God being the potter and we are the clay. And the Father, the potter, works with this clay. But what is the clay he's got? It's sinful, foolish clay. Human beings made of the dust. That's all he's got to work with, isn't it, on planet Earth? The amazing thing is he still does. Even after we see it in the life of David, that he's clay. Sinful, foolish clay. And yet God still works with him. And perhaps there's the hope of the story, not in David the hero, who's shown to be made of clay, our feet of clay, but in God the hero, who's going to use someone like David. And perhaps there comes a bit of hope for ourselves, because we're made of foolish, sinful clay, aren't we as well? And perhaps we might sometimes despair of the fact, how could God ever use me? How could God ever use us? Make such a mess of things. He's the potter. We're the clay. The thing of his amazing grace is that he works with us. He uses us for his glory. As we see in this chapter, God's promises cannot fail. David was not going to be swept away by the hand of Saul, and David was not going to be safe in the land of the Philistines, as he says at the beginning of chapter 21. David's plans fail, but God's promises don't. God is still working out those promises, and he's going to make David king. And so in the New Testament, we can cling to those promises. Even when doubt and despair come in, even when life is difficult, what is it that we can hold firm to? Those promises of God, which do not change.